I met all these just brilliant doctors who just had this, just this intuition and sense of the disease and what's needed and the right amount of, empiricism and trial and error and risk benefit analyses and just these fluid dynamic approaches to medicine, which is why I love medicine, right? Is that you're trying to solve these problems and you have to navigate all these variables of the patient and the medicines and the pathophysiology of the disease. And it's like this, it's just like this almost three-dimensional problem you're trying to solve. And so I met so many great doctors, so many great thinkers, and I call them little FLCCC. So like each one of them found like-minded individuals who knew that like the narrative and the general, like this train barreling down the tracks, we were heading in the wrong direction fast, and people were getting hurt.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity podcast. I am your host, Dr. Chris Martinson. And today, we welcome back Dr. Pierre Corey, firebrand, outspoken New York doctor that made waves early on in the COVID cycle and continues to make waves as an unapologetic champion of science, evidence-based medicine, and most importantly, putting patients first. I now count him among the people I trust most and a personal friend. I believe in Dr. Corey, and I believe in the excellent work that the supremely dedicated staff at the FLCCC are doing. They care, they're dedicated, and they are fighting a huge fight for all of us. I'm bringing Pierre back on today because it's time to shift the discussion. We need to let people know that continuing to live in ignorance, it's now a choice, one that they can actively turn away from and towards living again without fear and with a positive sense of the future. So it's time to change the narrative. It's time to get our lives back and to decide for ourselves where we place our attention and to manage our lives in accordance with our personal risk profiles, medical histories, and assessments. In short, it's time to move on and get back to living a healthy and fear-free life. Pierre, welcome to the program.
All right, Chris, thank you for that. I appreciate it. And yes, I count you as a friend and a like-minded colleague, actually, as we try to figure out how to navigate forward, which I think we're doing a good job of so far.
Well, I talked about taking a new leaf, a new narrative, and living more healthy. What are you up to right now?
I'm actually, I'm actually trying to get a little bit healthier. I just got out of a brutal ICU week, and I have a couple weeks off, and actually went on a little retreat, just trying to catch up on work. And I'm doing a water fast, actually, which I like to do, and it actually helps restore me. And I'm on day four, Chris, and I'm feeling really good.
Oh, excellent. Hey, that's really good to hear. So I want to start here. COVID, I think you and I have been at it about the same amount of time. We both started in early spring of 2020. And along that way, I have to tell you, Pierre, unfortunately, a lot of my heroes were killed by COVID. It's just none of them died from the disease. I lost a lot of people along the way who I admired and respected. And I've also gained people who I really admire and respect. In many ways, this has been a great reshuffling of who I count as among my colleagues, my friends. And I believe I've made friends for life out of this. And so I want to talk about that process because it's a tale of two worlds. There's one world where I see people who have, I don't know what happened to them, Pierre. Whenever they wake up, I'll welcome them back with gracious, compassionate arms. But until that point in time, many of them are operating to me, and this sounds a little harsh, but I believe it's true, as intellectual frauds and moral cowards. They are not following the data. They are afraid of losing job status, money, something, I don't know what. And as a consequence of that, they are not following the data. They're not helping people. They're not putting patients first. But on the other side of that, there are people who've risked it all. I count you among those to do the right things. So that's been my impression of it. I would just love to get your take on it.
I'd love everything you just said. It's been really my experience as well. I mean, first of all, I like the friends for life thing. Well, let me get back to that in a second, because my gosh, the people I've met in what's a journey, right? Life is a journey. And this stretch of road has been absolutely unique in my life. I've never gone through so much personal and intellectual change and challenges, where I've actually had to, like you said, I've had to leave off former colleagues, mentors, even where not only we don't talk so much, but when we have talked, we quickly learn that we really couldn't find, like, there was just not we always discussed and argued and debated stuff before, but something happened here. And I agree. Like, I just, there's like a little bit of an estrangement. And when you talk about, like, you know, I don't want to say who got it right or wrong, but let's go back to that data point that you made. It's that, you know, why did they do this, or why are they thinking that way? And I want to say one thing is that I want to be really humble. Is that I think, you know, like, you know that phrase, "But for the grace of God, go I." Like, I think that could have happened to me. I think the journey that I took, or the path that I'm on, was really due to my close connections with really serious intellectual and data-driven folks who helped me to see really where the solutions were, what we really should do. And by being around those folks, I was able to, I think, get a lot of things right. Had I been, let's say, like where I'd been for my whole career, like in New York, you know, where there's like this strong narrative and all those big academic centers are telling you what to do and what not to do and what to believe, and you're overworked and don't have time and no one's showing you how to critically analyze or get that data. If you don't devote the time and really ask the difficult questions, you're going to go along with what's being told, and you're going to be trusting in authority. And like, I think it's okay to trust in what you think are authoritative experts. The problem is if you get it wrong and you trust in those who are supposed to be expert and supposed to be giving good guidance, and they're not. And that was the catastrophic error. And I feel like many of my colleagues simply trusted too much in supposedly authoritative and supposedly altruistic agencies. I mean, Chris, you know, I went into this thinking, I literally came into this thinking that our agencies had our public health, the health of the public as their primary goal and objective and purpose. And therefore all of their actions and guidance would be directed towards the elevation of that. But tell me when I sound crazy, by the way.
Keep going.
Descend further into madness. And, you know, I hate to make a joke of that, but I mean, that's where I started. And I found that, you know, that trust started to erode the more I learned and the more I investigated. So like, I started out this road with Paul Marrick, who is, you know, one of the greatest medical intellectuals I've ever met. I mean, he consumes papers at a rate you wouldn't believe. And he has these habits, which have just basically elevated me as a doctor. You know what his best habit is? Like, when he has a question about a paper that he's read or he has an idea, he literally calls either the first or the senior author of the paper, or he emails them directly. And he gets these really rich insights, because when you read an academic paper, there's a lot of nuance that might not make it, or that the peer reviewers removed. And so Paul gets this rich sort of texture and insight into stuff. And so when I started out with Paul, when we formed the FLCCC, and suddenly the paper started flying, we started reading and reading and just questioning. And then I started meeting more and more folks. And then when we met you, and like, we saw that you were also data driven and you were also asking the right questions and really knew how to, with your $150 a month Comcast connection,
that's the secret,
we're able to navigate this trove of really rich data and knowledge. And so basically, I feel like I was dragged along by some intellectual giants, and I just got to learn how to find the knowledge that was going to give us good judgment and good direction. And by doing that, it made me an expert at COVID in many of its aspects. And you know, hopefully that expertise that we gained, I think it's added value. And so I started out talking about Paul and then you. And then when you talk about all the friends that you've made for life, I mean, you know, I think I became more of a public face of the FLCCC, you know, because of that testimony. And also, I'm much more of a social and outgoing being, I think, than Paul. Paul's more the reclusive intellectual. And so like I've forged like these, I mean, literally a global network of colleagues, you know, because I don't want to sound egotistical, but when I talk about their organizations in all these other countries that reached out, like like-minded individuals who just sort of got it, like knew what not to trust, knew how to find out the right answers, knew the right amount of skepticism, and just knew what common sense, what I don't even know what the word for common, do we have a new word for common sense? Like, have we figured out a synonym for that? Because it's not so common.
Unobtainium.
Wait, say that again?
Unobtainium.
What does unobtainium mean?
It's like you can't get it. It's almost impossible to find.
Oh, that's what it is. It's unobtainium.
It's not so, that, it's a new element. It's very rare.
Yeah, so they were steeped in unobtainium. And so, you know, I met all these just brilliant doctors who just had this intuition and sense of the disease and what's needed and the right amount of, you know, empiricism and trial and error and risk benefit analyses and just these fluid dynamic approaches to medicine, which is why I love medicine, right? Is that you're trying to solve these problems and you have to navigate all these variables of the patient and the medicines and the pathophysiology of the disease. And it's like this, it's just like this almost three-dimensional problem you're trying to solve. And so I met so many great doctors, so many great thinkers, and I call them little FLCCC. So like each one of them found like-minded individuals who knew that like the narrative and the general, like this train barreling down the tracks, we were heading in the wrong direction fast, and people were getting hurt. They were getting run over, you know, with this juggernaut, like this monolithic answer to everything, these blanket kind of just no nuance, no understanding, like, you know, the mask everywhere, you know, running down a highway at 40 miles, you know, running down a highway on the side of the road with a mask, you know, like that's like the absurd levels, you know, and so anyway, I just like all the folks, all the little organizations, like these little grassroots organizations of scientists and physicians and who reached out to me, who appreciated some of my lectures, appreciated the testimony. And like, you know, it almost makes me kind of like, I mean, tears almost come to my eye. I'll tell you, let me just tell you an anecdote. So this sentiment that you just talked about, Chris, about, you know, this journey and the people we've met, the people we've kind of, I'm going to say temporarily left behind, because I do think, you know, I love some of my former colleagues and mentors. I just think that we're in this two different intellectual worlds, but I think we can find each other again. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I got to tell you, 2 weeks ago, Tess Laurie wrote to me, and she wrote me this, just like this beautiful email, just saying, oh God, I think I'm going to cry. She just wrote, like, she just said, like, how much she appreciated me and how important it was that we sort of met and we kind of, you know, were fighting for the right things. And I just, she just, it was just nice to hear from her how much she appreciated me. So you're not supposed to make me cry, Chris.
it's turning into something of a habit of mine.
So, yeah, apparently. Yes, you've done this before, actually.
I did once. I didn't do anything, but.
But.
I think that speaks to the level of connection you two have at this point. And have you met her in person?
No, I mean, I haven't traveled to Europe yet, but you know, that's another really kind of cool thing is that like, I can't wait to travel. I have friends in every country of the world.
Yes.
And like, not only that, but like, I literally want to see them and have dinner. You know, like I have like some of the coolest people that like just like-minded folk, you know, just, you know, bold, big personalities, big brains, you know, just interesting. Many of them have great senses of humor too, which is really cool because I consider myself to have a good sense of humor and just like, just super fun people. And I just anticipate like, you know, and like you said, friends for life. So I know there's places I can go where I can find someone and just learn a ton and share and just, you know, like I say with my old buddies, you know, just shoot the shit and, you know, good stuff.
Well, so let's talk. So if you could, how do you characterize this new tribe, this new collection of people who you count among the people who really excite you and invigorate you and inspire you and maybe nourish you, as tested in that email? How would you characterize them? Okay, they have good senses of humor. They're intellectually curious. What is it about them that you would say binds them?
You know, I think, you know, first of all, I think they have a lot of wisdom in the sense they know what the systems that we're under, and we know the influences of those systems. And so they know where to apply skepticism. Mm. And I would say many of them were much less naive than when I started. So, I think they have a general wisdom of the world and how it works. And so they just know how to navigate a little bit better and to be critical thinkers. And then I just have to, maybe I'll repeat myself, but very data driven. I mean, they are hungry for data. I mean, they don't try to form opinions. And it's not just data. It's not reading in a newspaper article, right? Because that's the other thing. I mean, I think some people might confuse that with, well, I read a lot. Well, what are you reading? Right? You know, and it's really the source data. And where I found the most truth, and the people who get this right, it's literally people who are like at the source of the stream. Like, you got to go to source data. And even source data we know can be suspect and manipulated. So you even have to have healthy skepticism there. But the farther you go upstream, you know, past all the filters that knowledge came through, like all the experts who gave their opinions of that data, and then the journalists they talked to, and, you know, I mean, all of those filters, I mean, what comes out like that in newspapers is so curated and so, I would say, even manipulated. And I don't want to sound crazy about that, but those people are like that, right? I mean, they're very data driven. And so they know how to ask the right questions, and they know how to find the best answers. Are they going to get everything right all the time? No, but we're going to get it more right than others by using those approaches. And we're still going to get fooled. I still think that we can be presented manipulated data and maybe not recognize it and make a judgment on it. But you know what? We're also humble. None of us profess that, like, we're always right or always going to get it right. And we're willing to, and that's the other thing. I think we're all willing to adapt to new information. You know, I know that we are. I mean, Paul always established that with our protocols, is that we're going to evolve with the data. And we have, you know, we've elevated some things. We've changed doses. We de-emphasize others. And so we're willing to adapt with new data. That's it. It's not a fixed knowledge or a fixed policy or a fixed opinion. Mm-hmm. And that's why they're so fun to talk to. Right. And I change my opinions after talking. They're like, they'll give me something I hadn't thought about, or a different angle, or some data that they got that I didn't. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's like almost like this data factory. Like, the more people I talk to, the more I interact with, you know, the more I learn and the more expert I become. And so I think that's why your followers like to listen to you, because you're one of those, I think you're like a nexus of a lot of information, and I think you put it out. And so anyway, I think that's how I think of those folks.
That's interesting. You know, I feel like this is actually a new renaissance, and it's empowered by this thing called the internet, because if it hadn't been for this thing called the internet, if this thing came 30 years ago, you and I wouldn't know each other, right?
Nope.
You would have maybe sat on some real private knowledge, you know, maybe with a small group of doctors somewhere in Michigan, and it would have stayed there, and it would have taken 30 years to spread a little bit more broadly. But now, so I think this is the big battle as I see it. You have these people who believe in institutional centralized, the CDC owns all the data, as if you have to wait for this big sclerotic bureaucratic institution with all sorts of conflicts of interests and egos and crazy stuff to sort of sift through stuff. We know how that takes decades. Meanwhile, using a Comcast connection, people like us and you and your doctor network have managed to show that the information that can be developed out at the edge and shared is lightning speed compared to the old model. So I almost feel like in some ways you represent sort of the capitalism of medicine and the CDC represents the Soviet Union. And I don't understand the people who put their faith in that bureaucracy as any sort of paragon of anything, because it's demonstrably slow, if not conflicted, and often wrong. And that's all provable.
You know, Chris, can I say one thing about that? Because, and I'm going to be very humble before I say this, but I was in Washington last week. And so I had a roundtable kind of discussion with the Congressional Doctors Caucus. So there's like 17 doctors in Congress. And one of the members invited me to talk to them. And about six were there, some were on Zoom. And it was a really interesting discussion. And there was another presenter there. And anyway, the point of this is that what I learned there in just a little short time that I spent in Washington, because I talked a lot about the agencies and how from the outside, I can't understand what comes out of those agencies because it's totally discordant with good common sense, pragmatic medicine, effective medicine, and it seems to miss a lot. And so one of the things that I learned from someone who's been working in those agencies, he said, you know, good science is not enough. Like, let's say you're someone who's uncovered good science and you bring it through that agency, you try to get that turned into policy. He said, basically, you're dealing with lots of competing science. So like, there'll be a faction who wants to only focus on antiviral therapy and then ignore all the immunomodulatory therapy. And so you'll have like these power structures, which will ignore hugely important parts of the science in order to champion another. And then within there, they have their own little ponies. And so like what comes out, and he said, basically, to get anything done, it's all about relationships. It's not science. It's about relationships, hierarchy, little dose of money, or maybe a large dose of money, Chris. I think that helps oil grease the wheels. But it's this Byzantine cog, and it's not like, you don't just sit down and figure out a problem. It's this huge institution. And to get whatever comes out the top had to do like this, you know, an intricate maze of relationships that you have to navigate, fueled by money and arguments, and then whatever the science du jour is. And then ultimately there's leaders that dictate what comes to the surface and what doesn't, right? And so you're right. When you look at an institution like that and you're looking for a fleet, like on their feet, nimble thinking, dynamic, evolving with the data, scientific unit, right? Or medical unit. And I said this many months ago. I was like, what this pandemic needs is like a SEAL Team 5, like a small group, you know, who can figure out a problem and navigate quickly in an emergency. And those institutions are not that. And if anyone questions whether they're not that, I don't think you can question it, right? Where we sit today and we see where we are with this pandemic and how poorly it's been controlled. When you look at what happened this summer, and I think the summer's not over because the cases are still high, although they're starting to come down, seasonality. But we did worse than a year ago. Mm-hmm. And that's with the best these guys can offer. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So clearly those institutions are not up to the task. And I'm sure they do some things well and they're important for certain things. But boy, for a pandemic, are they ill-suited?
Yeah, let me not throw them entirely under the bus. I love when they take these giant databases and put 30 PhDs against them and sift through and create like 90 tables and, you know, all these regression analyses. They actually, so when the CDC did their mortality study, I actually learned something from that because they said, here are the comorbidities that are associated with outcomes. And I was like, oh, that's valuable information. And there were a few surprises in there. So that's good data. But in terms of this nimbleness, I'll tell you that I am actually embarrassed at how little I knew about viral diseases before this started, because I had been trained. First 2 years of my pathology degree at Duke is med training. You went through the same thing, right? We all had our biochemistry and the this's and that's. And I had my virology then, and I can't believe how unbelievably outdated it is. So what I've learned now about some of our favorite compounds that have antiviral components is the multifactorial nature of it, just how brilliant a virus is in its stratagems to reproduce and evade immune systems and detune parts of the inner intracellular mechanism through its DNA binding and modification behaviors. Like it's a genius little package. And so it turns out I've learned things about how every drug has multiple targets and in combination, they have synergistic effects often, and that these things were not known to me. Maybe they were known to you, but I learned a lot. So I'm grateful for that because I take vitamin D daily now.
Let me correct one thing is that, so most of what I've learned, because I think you've been much more steeped in the science, the biochemistry, the biology, and the thing that I've learned the most is, like, I'm gonna dumb myself down real quick, is that I literally went into this pandemic believing what I've been taught my whole career, which is that there is no specific antiviral therapy. I mean, yes, we have acyclovir for, you know, herpes simplex. Mm-hmm. We have ganciclovir for CMV. But outside of that, I mean, you get a cold, you just rest. You know, there was nothing specific. Yes, grandmas would tell you to take vitamin C. There's vitamin C does work. It's like a smidge, especially at modest oral doses. But there's really nothing specific you can do. And now here I am 18 months later. Oh my gosh. I mean, there's literally two dozen compounds with, now we have trials evidence showing pretty profound large magnitude benefits, either in the duration of symptoms, the duration of viral transmission, hospitalization, and death. I mean, we have a number of molecules that actually reduce mortality in what's turned out to be a deadly viral disease. This isn't the common cold, right? We're clear on that. But, but like, I went from there's nothing to do for a virus. Now, anytime I have a cold going forward, or any of my children, or any other virus that comes at us, we already have like a whole armory of stuff that we can employ. And the data for those, which are best, which should be employed, is just going to increase. And so I think it's just this awesome new body of knowledge that we have is antiviral therapeutics. And I will mention also, Chris, is that of those two dozen, probably 90% are repurposed. Which are to say, like, cost pennies and readily available.
Without naming names, I think I know what you're talking about. So
exactly.
So, but to me, that's really valuable knowledge, because I actually feel like now I have agency in my own health that I didn't have before, which is amazing, right? And it's, again, maybe it's sort of the inside versus outside orthodoxy versus the new rebel army. People now have, if they choose, can avail themselves of this information and actually be their own frontline doctors, as it were, instead of just sort of like, well, I got a cold, so I'm just going to rest and wait for it to pass. There are things people can do now. And I think that's in my tribe of people. People are like sharing all kinds of information, all sorts of very subtle things that they're trying. Some of them have those two dozen things that range from things that I probably would have been dismissive of 2 years ago. Hey, of course. I'm taking this herb now for da da da. Yep. 2 years ago, I would have been like, right. But now I go, well, I don't know. What's your data? Let me see, you know, how do we know? I'm very much more open to things now.
You don't know. If you said 2 years ago, you would have thrown this out. I mean, half the things that, like, now I'm open to, and I'm like, you know, I read about the physics, you know, like, it's funny, like, reading about something like curcumin or Nigella sativa, right? Which a year ago, if someone told me, if you take, you know, Nigella sativa, like black cumin seed, and it would save your life in a viral disease, I would literally burst out laughing. Just leave me alone. I got to do some real doctoring here. Or you take your seeds and just don't talk to me.
Yeah.
But when you look, there's literally like a 10 years of lots of little trials and studies that have evaluated and defined multiple mechanisms of black cumin seed, from like immunomodulatory, anti-inflammatory, antiviral. So you have all of these building blocks, and then you have this trial from Pakistan, large randomized controlled trial with like really large magnitude benefits of literally, I don't know if you saw this study, but Nigella sativa and honey. Mm-hmm. And then you find out about honey. Honey has also these like pleiotropic properties. And so, like, I mean, what's happened to me, Chris? Like, I'm literally like, I'm like a real doctor. And I'm like, I think you should take Nigella sativa and honey. It will save your life. But going back to the agency comment. So when you talk about it, it's so satisfying because now we have agency and so many people have agency by learning these things and by disseminating this knowledge of things that are readily available, cheap, doesn't need a prescription, that you can actually treat yourself with very safe compounds. Not only is that agency so satisfying, but boy, does it seem critical for the future. Mm. Is this going to be the last viral pandemic? Please, Chris, no more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. So you're humoring me.
Yeah. That's the sound of a shoe that's about to drop. You know?
Exactly. But yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I'm like transformed. And the thing is, having learned that there's like this era of molecules that I would, or compounds that I would normally dismiss, because I got to tell you, I was biased. I mean, if it doesn't come with the pharmaceutical company imprimatur and these complex multi-center double-blind randomized controlled trials, you know, and doesn't come through guidelines from these major academic societies, it's probably nonsense. It's probably some naturopath. And I don't want to put down naturopaths. Mm-hmm. I probably would have 2 years ago. Now I'm like, wow, these guys actually might know what they're talking about because they're using really effective compounds that are based in good science. And now, like when they say that I found this to be effective, I definitely listen. Mm-hmm. I still need trials data of some sort. That as a scientist, as a physician, unfortunately, I did need some trials data. It doesn't have to be the big, shiny $25 million ones, but we do need some sort of rational experiments to evaluate true efficacy. And so
I'd love to get your take on this because I'm still a big fan of observations, right? And so yes. I look at Fareed and Tyson and they say, hey, we've had 7,000 people come through with COVID. As long as we got them within 5 to 7 days and started a early treatment regimen, zero deaths. To me, that's a profound and important observation, particularly when they're in a county, when you case match it, that experienced a much, you know, 750 people died in the remaining 23,000 cases they had in that county. So that seems significant. And that observation to me says, in a healthy world, Pierre, the CDC rides in and says, what did you do? Let us see your data. Let's look
healthy
at this.
Healthy world.
In a healthy world, and they say, we're gonna replicate this in some other places. If it bears out, this is the new standard, right?
Yep. No. And when I say trials data, actually, I want to amend that statement. I was actually speaking specifically for FLCCC protocols. So we have to have some criteria for the protocols. I will say for my personal practice, I am definitely a little bit more liberal. I will do something certainly if I a trusted colleague, or I'll just find out pretty quickly on my own, which is I'll try something. If it's safe, it's reasonable. I know it. And the disease is bad, I'll try it. And, you know, listen, I will never forget my index case with ivermectin on a personal level. So I had already come out as a proponent after reading the trials and the science and talking to folks all around the world. And then I used it on my first patient, right? So I already put my paper on a preprint before I had treated anyone. So I'd done this comprehensive review. And then it was actually a CEO of a company who had contacted me because they had seen the preprint and they were sick with COVID and they had a prolonged illness. They were 2 weeks into their COVID, still having fevers and night sweats. And they had a resting tachycardia, heart rate of 120 and at rest in bed. And so they were still quite sick and treated with ivermectin. And she told me that within a couple hours, she had like these, she felt really terrible, like night sweats and flushing. And she didn't know what was going on. She felt terrible, but she woke up in the morning, heart rate of 80, felt like $1 million, and she didn't have a fever again. Now, you know, the ivory towers would say anecdotal, coincidental, she was going to get better anyway, on that Sunday, I remember it was a Sunday night. On that Sunday night, she was going to get better anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, it had nothing to do with the fact that I gave her an ivermectin on that Sunday night. But like, literally, I saw what was only, you know, it could only be interpreted as this phenomenal beneficial response to a medicine. And so like, when we talk about data that we use, like, I'm sorry, but I was sold right there on the first dose, like mm-hmm. first patient, first dose. And then I had just repeated experiences. And so when you see a guy like Fareed or Tyson talk about the 6,000, I mean, they knew after the first 10, right. You know, that they could see the patients like, hey, I felt better. Hey, doc, you gave me this yesterday. I'm feeling much better today. And whether you give it to him on day 2 or day 4 or day 5, and you keep seeing those things, you know that the medicine's working. And so I agree.
I understand, you know, people say, oh, you know, anecdotes, sometimes people randomly get better. Sometimes they randomly die. Things happen. But as a doctor, you know that you're actually intimate with a patient. So you're watching their charts and they might be going like this down a chart and they have a progression and you've seen this enough that you know where this is going. but then you give the ivermectin and then all of a sudden this happens. Is that what you're saying? That like,
Chris, remember, I'm a lung and ICU expert, right? So especially in the hospital, all I'm treating is acute illnesses. And when you're treating an acute illness, much different than a chronic illness, but acute illnesses, it's all about trajectories. So what you just did with your finger is essentially what I look for every, and when we, what we call make rounds on patients, so you see your patients every day, you're following their course, it's all about trajectories. And in the ICU, I have to be really knowledgeable about their sometimes minute to minute or hour to hour trajectory. And basically, I teach medicine. I've spent my whole career teaching medicine. I teach my trainees this, is that, you know, generally when I start to see, especially in critical illness, if I see the trajectory worsen and I institute therapies and then I see a trajectory on the improvement, I always say, just stand back. They're getting better. They're going to continue to get better. Don't get any fancy ideas, no new tests, no new anything. They're starting to improve. Just trust in that trajectory and they do better. If the trajectory is poor and they're declining and I institute therapies and they continue to, well, then I got to change what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And I have to redouble my efforts, figure out, what am I missing? Am I treating the right diseases? Is it the right drug? Is there any other options? Or do I need to increase doses? And so you always are responding to trajectories. And what happens is, over time, the other thing that I explain to trainees, and many of them are so fresh out of medical school, they have those thick textbooks like pretty much lodged into their brains, whereas like mine are pretty dusty, like the textbooks. And so what I tell them, like the difference between, you know, an expert and a non-expert is it's not actually necessarily the knowledge base, right? Like you guys have a ton of knowledge. We read the same books, the same textbooks. Yes, I might have read things a few more times than you, but it's really pattern recognition. You know, what I have is like, I can see a patient. I know what they look like. I just noticing patterns and trajectories. And that's what, the longer you are in medicine, the better you are, the more familiar you are with that. And so once you have an acute sense of patterns, you can detect the benefits of medicines. Because like, if I see someone, I know how they look, I know their age, I know what typically their trajectory was, and then I give them a medicine, and they suddenly are doing much better, much quicker than I normally would have anticipated, it's not unreasonable to say, I think it was the medicine I gave them. Mm-hmm. And I think it was that medicine at that dose. And so, you know, the longer you've been doing this, the more you can tell medicines that work and don't. And I can also tell pretty quickly when a medicine didn't work, right? Mm-hmm. That's actually always pretty clear. It's like, gee, not only did they not show any response, but they seem worse today, you know? And so, you know, you know quickly what works and what doesn't. Mm-hmm. So anyway.
And your experience with ivermectin in that first case was you saw a trajectory, you gave it, and then you saw a different trajectory.
I heard a trajectory from the woman. She'd been ill for it. Literally, she said she was in her second week. So she was like this, not doing well, not necessarily worse, but just felt terrible. And she was long phase into this. This is back in the alpha variant, but literally she was a little bit older, a little bit overweight. And then suddenly you saw, boom, she improved. You know, literally on the day, within 12 hours of me treating her. And then within a couple of patients, my next patient, I treated them in the morning. They got their first dose in the morning. And they called me the next day. They said, you know what? Unbelievable. Like by evening last night, I started to feel much better. The tightness in my chest relieved. And so, again, those are just two, you know, this goes back to what you brought up, which is that don't forget, you know, case series. Clinical experience. And like, so sometimes it's really what we call an N of one, right? A sample size of one sometimes is all you need, especially if you're an expert at trajectories and patterns and diseases. And so you can figure out things much quicker than a massive multi-center double-blind randomized controlled trial.
Well, I think what's disappointing to me in that story is to find that just this morning, I was reading about renewed guidance from a medical center about the use of remdesivir and sort of tweaking a little bit about the oxygen levels or something. But it's got to be clear from the data that it doesn't work. What do you have personal experience watching remdesivir in action?
I have not seen any alteration of trajectory. And when I talk to, I've had people say, oh, man, that stuff works. So I've had doctors tell me it works. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how they determine that, because I've never seen a change in trajectory from remdesivir. I think people have given it and some have gotten better, so they think it works. And like, I'm sorry. And by the way, I've never actually initiated remdesivir. Well, first of all, it's because I'm an ICU doctor. And so by the time they get to me, they've already been on it. Mm-hmm. I basically, the only thing I've done with remdesivir is stop it or allow it to complete its course. Because the problem is, even though I've felt at times that it might be harmful and I should stop it, you know, a lot of times patients, everybody feels that it's critical and life-saving. The agencies are telling you to use it. They're on day 8 and I'm just like, you know, I don't want to cause problems, because then sometimes families feel, I do need the trust in some of my families in the ICU. They do need to have trust that you're trying to do the right thing. And it's very hard to explain to them sometimes why you might stop a medicine. And so anyway, but yeah, remdesivir, I have not seen, I mean, I don't know, maybe those who've used it earlier. Let me be full humility here, is that I'm much farther on the line. So I wouldn't see a response. I probably am not the guy who's going to see one. Mm-hmm. Everyone who comes to me, they've already gotten their remdesivir. So I have a very warped view of the drug.
Yep.
The data also tells the other part of the story that I can't.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Well, so. It's so to complete the, or get more on this idea of a positive narrative, I'm sure you have a different perspective on this, but from where I'm sitting, which might be, maybe I don't have the best perspective in the world because I live in a fairly rural spot, but I will tell you at this point in time, I don't fear COVID anymore, because I believe that if somebody is under the age of 70 and in reasonable health and has access to early treatment, that it's something you need to take seriously. I treated it. I think it's a serious disease. If I had it, I would want to get early treatment as early as possible. But beyond that, I got to be honest, Pierre, I'm not walking around with fear around this at this point.
So one of the things I say, you know, because I do some lectures and, you know, like now I'm doing interviews. I try to keep them to podcasts. I stay away from newspapers and TV now. There's just not really a point there. But I got to tell you, independent journalists and podcasts are just, those are really fun because you really get to discuss, debate and all that. But they oftentimes ask me, like, is there anything you want to say that you haven't said or whatever? And my message is, this is a really highly treatable disease. I want everybody to know how treatable this is. And so when you say, like, you're not that worried about COVID anymore, I would amend that to say, I'm not worried about it for me, my friends, my families, my colleagues. I'm not worried about it for those who follow the FLCCC and our protocols, because we know that they're effective. And so, and I just hope that that umbrella of reassurance and protection, which is to say, there are effective treatments which will save your life and prevent the need for hospitalization. I just hope that number grows. But you're right, me personally, I'm not that bothered by COVID. As you know, I actually got COVID. It was a relatively mild case. And so I also have natural immunity in my camp. But really, it's mostly also for my friends, my family, and colleagues and patients. And you know, they're all going to be okay, except if they don't do the following. Because I want to do this as a word to the wise. One of the close friends and the supporters of FLCCC, one of my most cherished friendships that I've made, got sick with COVID and made the mistake thinking it was a cold, like just a cold. And like afterwards, when we talked about it, I was like, wait a second. We're in the middle of a global pandemic and the United States is under like a mass like catastrophe right now with COVID. And you thought this was the common cold? And like, and he's very sheepish about it. He feels that he doesn't know what he was thinking. I think it's because he had COVID. He wasn't thinking straight, but he didn't call me until day 7 or 8. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you, I had to pull out all the stops for him. I really had to use every tool in my arsenal to keep him out of the hospital. And so the point is, like, I think we shouldn't worry. But it's like you said, early treatment. Let's focus on that early. Don't wait. You know, I think if anyone has anything approximating a viral syndrome, it's COVID until proven otherwise, and take it. Here's another fun fact. My daughter actually got the common cold last week. And in her high school, a lot of kids got the common cold. It was bizarre. Like she said, a lot of kids were sick. Everybody tested negative for COVID, and it was like a routine common cold. I did not treat her with ivermectin, although I was tempted to. But there is such a thing as the common cold. But I still say I would treat anything, any viral syndrome right now until proven otherwise. You got to think that it's COVID.
Absolutely. So let me amend my statement, because if I was over 80 and presented with COVID in the UK medical system, I'd be terrorized at this point in time. And I'll tell you why. They just put out their age stratified data because they were comparing vaccinated to unvaccinated. And they said, oh, look how much better the vaccine is. And what they pointed out in this chart I'm looking at is that if you present 80 plus in their hospital system with COVID, you have a 28.9% chance of dying. That I could point them to the Dominican Republic and say, maybe you should look what they're doing, because they don't, nobody has a statistic that horrifying to me. So I would be terrorized if I was actually going to end up in whatever system is resulting in, still to this day, a 28. And by the way, I actually overstated that. This data is if you get COVID, not hospitalized, if you get COVID, according to their data, that's your chance of kicking it.
Oh, because I was going to say, for 80 plus in the UK with the treatments that are being used, I would say once you get to the hospital, that mortality rate must be higher.
Yeah.
Hospitalized patients, I mean, that must be higher than that. So
crude case, this is just crude case fatality rate. So,
right. So that's not the population who actually go to the hospital.
Right.
So.
But that's horrifying to me. I mean.
Right. But that's the thing. But it goes back to where we're not worried. And again, that's why I also said, like, although I'm not worried for my circle, I'm not worried for those who actually are seeking out guidance and good medical, management. But I am still concerned about all those who unfortunately are, they're not following the science. They're not following the data. They're not following the clinical experts that, mm-hmm. that have figured out how to treat this disease. And it's because we're being suppressed, but that message is getting out. And so I like it. Let's stay positive and we got to move forward. I mean, we got the answers. We just got to get the answers to everybody and we'll get there.
So to me, that's the most encouraging thing. Look, we know a lot about viral disease processes. We have a whole armamentarium we can bring to bear against COVID, as well as other common viruses or maybe even uncommon ones. Who knows what we'll find going down the road. And you've got all these friends all over the world now. And there are people who and doctors specifically who know how to actually treat the patient still and to use the data to make the best decisions. And so to me, that's all good news and
great news. And you know, Chris, let me say one thing, because I would be remiss, because I have to, like, I feel like I have to mention this at every opportunity I can. But when we talk about how we're not worried and we need to move forward, like, we have to talk just briefly about Uttar Pradesh, which mm-hmm. is the embodiment of what we're talking about, which is that there is the pandemic has been solved. The pandemic has been solved. Well, I should say, there is a large population of the world that solved the pandemic, right? Mm-hmm. So let's can we just run the numbers real quick?
Yes.
Uttar Pradesh, state in northern India, 241 million people. 241 million people, right? Their state health ministry and health minister put together a program centered around ivermectin. Now, they didn't eradicate the virus with just ivermectin. It was more things than that, but they did last summer. They were using hydroxychloroquine. Then they did a study with healthcare workers where they gave them ivermectin. And they found that in this prophylaxis study, none of the healthcare workers, despite massive exposures, were getting COVID. So they said, you know what? Let's change up the protocol, right? Data-driven, evolving with the science and the data. And they just said, okay. And they put it right into policy. So last August, they put into policy early treatment and prophylaxis of healthcare workers with ivermectin. They had some of the best numbers in the world. You were watching those numbers, Chris, mm-hmm. even before the catastrophe in April and May, right? After their summer surge last year, they did really well during the fall and spring. Got hit hard in the spring because they had so many migrant workers that rushed back, brought a ton of disease. But just as their cases went up like this, like a cliff, they went down like a cliff because they went to train stations, bus stations, and airports. testing and treating and testing and treating. But then at that surge until now, what they've done is they have this massive public health service, 70,000 plus healthcare workers traveling across the state to 97,000 villages, all armed with rapid tests, testing and treating and testing and treating. So they did massive amounts of tests, right? And their protocol centered around early treatment kits. So if they had a positive test, everyone got ivermectin with some supplements, multivitamin, I think vitamin D, vitamin C, I think an antibiotic as well. So there was more things in there, but we know what was carrying the water, right? Mm-hmm. So it was ivermectin for all positive cases, ivermectin for all those traveling healthcare workers, and then ivermectin for all household contacts of positive cases. They also did close contact tracing, surveillance, quarantine. They basically used all gumshoe, like I call it, like good old gumshoe public health work, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, contact tracing. And this is in one of the poorest states in India. Okay. Let's talk about what those efforts and what that strategy resulted. It resulted in essentially the eradication of the virus from a state of 241 million people, right? So on September 20th, they reported that out of their last 2.5 million tests, 2.5 million tests, 201 positives, which is a positivity rate of 0.007%, which is effectively zero. 67 of their 75 districts had no active cases. And so I just have to finish by saying what happened in Uttar Pradesh is not only a model for the world, but it is a historic public health achievement, which I think probably bests that of smallpox and polio. It almost gives chills to see what they accomplished in Uttar Pradesh. And you know, that message and that achievement needs to be disseminated. And that's why I feel like I can't waste any opportunity. And you know why, Chris? There's not a lot of opportunities to disseminate that knowledge, right?
Hmm. Well, and so every time I bring that up, you know, and Twitter's not a fair place because it's full of pharma trolls and just whatever. You don't really know what you're getting there. It's sort of like enemy territory, and you have to take everything there with sort of a grain of salt. Doesn't reflect reality, but people come back and say, oh, you just can't believe their numbers because it's a derelict, you know, poor country, and they're probably lying about their data. And I know they can't lie at that scale, because if you have an uncontained, uncontrolled, untested COVID epidemic, you're going to see the deaths are going to be there. You're going to hear the stories about the hospitals filling up and the lack of oxygen tanks because we're running out. And that's not the case. So I tend to trust that that's actually what happened. But
well,
the detractors
listen,
won't
the
even
WHO,
look at it.
The WHO even wrote this beautiful, glowing description of what Uttar Pradesh did, did it.
I didn't read ivermectin in that summary, though.
Oh, yeah. So that's the punchline, Chris, right? It's it just was missing one word. It was this beautiful, glowing demonstration of what excellent public health is. And it came from the WHO. They just forgot to include one. I'm sure it was just an innocent oversight, Chris. Innocent oversight. Don't be so sinister. Remember, we're trying to keep this positive. It was an innocent oversight. I'm sure they'll correct it soon after this podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm just in today, as we're recording this, there was just more ivermectin hit pieces coming out. BBC had a just a whopping good whopper that they like to tell. So I'm at this stage of the story. I'd love to get your feedback on this, which is that what I think is, as Lily Tomlin said, as cynical as I am, I find I can't keep up. You know, I entered into this period pretty red-pilled, as they say. I was very cynical coming into all this. And even with that, I still had this naive thought that once those first 1,000 patients through ivermectin trials, once that data came out, it would be absolutely unavoidable. And I was wrong.
Right. Chris, I don't know if you've heard this, but I've said this before. Like, when I uploaded my comprehensive review paper, which covered the decade of antivirals, all the emerging prophylaxis, early and late treatment, you know, Dr. Reiter's paper out of Broward County in Florida, where he looked at all the people in the hospital, massive mortality benefits when he did very close propensity match. I mean, it was unassailable. The data was so consistent, reproducible from centers and countries. Like, I literally uploaded that paper. And like, I was like, oh my God, like, this is, we're done. we're done. Like the pandemic's over. Like, you know, people are going to read this and they're going to use ivermectin. And like, and, you know, I think I had visions of Uttar Pradesh back then. I just didn't know it was just going to be in Uttar Pradesh and nobody else would know about it. But that was my vision at the time. And yet now we got a hit piece from BBC, but you know, so anyways, I identify with that. The other thing is, Brett Weinstein gave me the better phrase on that cynicism thing. So he taught me the phrase is, every time I think I'm being too cynical, it turns out I'm being naive. And I keep learning that lesson over. And like each time I'm like, think I'm being too cynical, it's actually, no, you're not even getting the half of it. It's worse than what you think. So I get it. I get it.
Yeah. So you just said, you know, there aren't that many opportunities to sort of like spread the Uttar Pradesh story. So major media isn't beating your door down at this point?
No, and they're not beating, you know, the minister, health ministers and officials in Uttar Pradesh, you know, and then just to carry that point, you know, two major newspapers in India carried glowing newspaper articles on Uttar Pradesh and same thing. And they gave such granular details. In fact, some of the details that I see came from those officials who were interviewed by major newspapers in Uttar Pradesh. They also forgot, it was a little bit of a coincidence maybe, because in those two articles, Chris, wait, is there a conspiracy going on? Because in those two articles, I don't recall reading the word ivermectin either. So maybe the BBC, they just, so maybe it's not the BBC's fault. They just, they might have read those articles, but didn't read, they must have not read about ivermectin. Okay. All right, so I'm sure we'll sort it out soon.
Yeah, I mean, I see these people, again, you know, I get in these little online battles, and there are these otherwise, I think, well-meaning people, but they take every ivermectin study and they tear it apart. Like, I don't like how they recruited this cohort, and they get really granular, and I'm waiting for them to apply that same perspicaciousness to a remdesivir study or to molnupiravir, right? Which is the new Merck drug, right? Molnupiravir has a really interesting story, but you know my background, my PhD is in pathology, but toxicology is my subspecialty. I have been scouring for any long-term tox data on molnupiravir. I want to find it because it's a mutagen. It doesn't operate anything like ivermectin, totally different mechanism of action. It's not, you know, people have called it Merckmectin or whatever. It's not.
No, not at all. No.
Totally different. I can't find any published tox data, which is a no-no. I am not aware of this.
Can I guess why? Can I make one guess why and you tell me if I get it right? Is it because the pharmaceutical company that was trying to bring it to market abandoned it 10 or 15 years ago because they didn't want to bring a mutagen to market? Do you think that's why there's no... Wait, does that make sense?
There's a little ring to that.
But you know, I mean, and literally now 15 years later or whatever, I think it was 2003 when they abandoned it, or 13, I can't remember, but now it's rushing back in to save the day, a mutagenic molecule that was abandoned by a pharmaceutical company back in the day.
Yeah. And all I can find is that the company involved and the principals there, they did what effectively is a phase one safety study, which I think the max tracking was a week or maybe 2 weeks or something on human volunteers at various dose levels. It was reasonably well tolerated within that construct, but as you know, a mutagen is something you would want to track at the reproductive and or oncology levels over time. And I'd want to see those 3 month, 6 month, 12 month animal studies as a starting point. Can't find any of that data.
Yep. And I thought I'd read that in the more recent study, they're supposed to do 7 month follow-up. Now, I don't even know if 7 month follow-up is long enough. I mean, how long is pregnancy, by the way? Oh,
well, you have nine women, I hear it's only a month.
Oh, don't do that, Chris. No, but here's the other thing. You can't follow up those women. You know why? They weren't in the trial, right? So when you look at the exclusion criteria, so it was men who participated in heterosexual sex. without contraception. So you can't have sex unless you have a contraceptive while you take it, or just before, or just after. It's all women of childbearing age who aren't pregnant or breastfeeding, because those are out, right? And then you can just be a woman of childbearing age who might want to participate in heterosexual sex, and you'd have to use contraception, right? And so like that's a pretty big portion of the population, mm-hmm. right? Of men who like to participate in heterosexual sex and women. Yeah. That's kind of what makes the world go round, isn't it? So,
yes, it is.
So I mean, so, you know, even this drug, I mean, it's going to have huge restrictions. I mean, it's not going to be for everyone. And so, you know, I did an exercise last night. We did our weekly FLCCC webinar, and I kind of walked people through like what it takes to come on an FLCCC protocol, and like all the we want to know the mechanisms of the drug, whether it meets the pathophysiology of the disease. You know, we want to know what some, you know, obviously the phase 1, phase 2, we want to know trials, that we need some trials data. Is it credible? Is it enough, right? Is it just one trial and then you rush to regulatory approval? I mean, what drug would do that, Chris? I mean, what drug goes to regulatory approval? Oh, I'm sorry. Remdesivir, molnupiravir. Wait, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Oh, so I guess there are some drugs that rush through over the bar of one study. Ivermectin has 64 studies, 32 randomized controlled trials, and they can't get over the bar. And yeah. So,
Or two of those might be suspect. So I'm sorry.
Yeah. And they might not be high quality. And so anyway, but I mean, you get it, but yeah, that medicine is not going to be the panacea for the world. It's got to come out with serious restrictions to who can use it and when. And then once you see those restrictions, it's going to scare off a lot of people,
yeah.
Right? I mean, vaccine hesitancy, molnupiravir hesitancy. I mean, anything that which has potential unknown downstream, either acute or long term, is going to make humans cautious at ingesting it. I mean, it's human nature, right? So. Yeah. I don't know.
Now, I'm really glad you brought up the FLCCC weekly webinar, because it's just this gem that's put out all the time. And I know you've had tremendous success with it. You had to up your seat license with Zoom, because it's a webinar and hosting it across Zoom. So you went from, I remember when you were at 1,000 seats, then had to go to 3,000 seats.
Oh, I think we started at 350, and yeah. Then we finally bested 1,000, and then 5,000, and now I think we're getting 7,000 to 8,000 live viewers, and then you know people watch it afterwards too. So it's pretty, yeah. People like I think people like hearing the information that we provide. So
well, indeed they do, and I wanted to raise this as you know, they say the greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing people he didn't exist. Right. The greatest trick that social media has created for us is that we're alone, we're isolated, we must be crazy for having these thoughts. But the success of that webinar, plus the contacts you have, plus my own personal experience, I just want to, this is the coming out party to say we're not alone.
Yeah.
There's a lot of us, and we're sick to death of whatever that other program of fear. And I mean, people, we're closing in on 2 years of people's lives being lost. Unnecessarily. That's what Uttar Pradesh says. If you really look at the Uttar Pradesh data, it says it didn't have to be this way.
Yes.
We could have done this not stupidly, but we're still being stupid. And somehow that's gotten entrenched and I don't understand it. But guess what? It doesn't have to be that way. And that's what I wanted to have this seminar. what am I doing? I'm interviewing. This is a podcast.
It's a podcast.
So yeah, I just want to put people on notice that there are a lot of us out there, and I wanted to get your perspective on that. And so,
we'll get there. We're going. We'll get there. Yeah. And I like, at the risk of sounding egotistical, but it's like, I think we're just putting out, you know, if we were putting out crap that didn't make sense, that didn't marry people's experiences, and it didn't lead to the results that we claim or that we recommend it will, you know, I don't think we would be gaining in popularity. And so you put out good, credible information, which is support. We share our data. We say why we, you know, I constantly am giving little slide talks about, you know, what we're doing and why and what the studies show. And so it's, I don't know. I mean, people can, it's really, it allows you to look under the hood, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas like, you know, and that's the other alarming thing with the agencies, that the transparency of these policies is just not there. The underlying science and data is not being provided. And so I think it creates, unfortunately, mistrust and a lot of attacks. Whereas if you're freely open and transparent and willing to debate, so few want to debate us. I mean, I mean, you see the pot shots in the media, but anyway, I like the popularity, just like Peak Prosperity. I mean, you know, I think you use the term the tribe. I mean, you have this big following. We call it the army, the FLCCC army. And the reason why I like the army, because they're active. Like they're actually active. I mean, they're challenging the pharmacists. They're talking to their doctors, you know, they're writing to pharmacy boards, you know, like, because we're actually a little bit at war. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't think war is an overstatement here. There is a war on truth. There's a war on free discourse and sharing of opinions. You know, one of the catastrophic things is the way they branded misinformation on the level of a felony. You know, someone who has an opinion that differs from the agencies is automatically medical misinformation, and it's treated as if it's a scourge of society that needs to be extinguished. And like, yeah. I think people are fighting back against that. And so, I don't know. It's nice to hear the army and the tribe is growing. And I think the most important is that I think we're helping people. We're arming mm-hmm. people with, like you said, agency and the ability to navigate a pretty confusing world. Right. I mean, if I was an average citizen right now, you do have some misinformation, some true misinformationists. Then you have those who aren't but are branded as misinformationists. I would count myself as one of those. And then you have the disinformation on the other side. Someone who doesn't have the time, the faculties, the access, or the experience with analyzing and going to source data and critically thinking, come up with opinions. I am so sorry for them. Who the hell are you going to believe?
I know. Yeah. Well, thankfully, we've got you. You're operating, obviously, with high integrity. You're a great communicator. You do take the time to sift through all the data and help bring it to people. I think that I'm old enough now that I don't claim that I've got the truth. But, man, I'm really good at smelling bullshit.
Good.
Know, so it's like my superpower, yeah. Right? But so I know what's not right in this story more easily than I for sure know what's true. But over time, the truth emerges. And like you say, if the protocols don't work, they'll get outed. If the data's not right, it'll get outed over time. But only if you're faithful to the process of abandoning stuff that isn't working in favor of things that are. And,
yeah,
you know, that takes a certain level of integrity, you know, and not everybody yep. has that. So that's what's gotten to rewind to the beginning of this and circle it out to the close is I find that this period of time is like a fire that's burned away all that's false. We find out who stands tall and who we can believe, and the rest, not yet. Maybe they'll join us. Maybe they never will. I don't know. But it feels like this is like something I think humans have gone through multiple times, because I can read about epics like this in history books and in religious texts. It seems to be a human thing. We go yep. through periods where there's a little bit of a delusion that sort of takes hold and people really fervently believe it. And then later they pretend like nobody they know ever believed that stuff, you know? So we're
it's
back
so
to Schopenhauer's
true.
Three stages of truth, right? You know?
It's so true. But that obsession which takes hold, which leads herds of people to do really strange things that later on, yeah, I mean, I don't know what they're going to do later on, but there's a lot of people who've proposed and enacted and executed really unfortunate policies, and I hope we're all going to live and learn.
Yeah, well, I want to give you an opportunity here. FLCCC is the organization. COVID-19criticalcare.com is the website, but FLCCC.net will get you there. And you are a donation-based organization. I've donated. I think people should donate. It's a really you guys for you guys pack a punch. You pack a real punch for your boxing way out of your weight.
You know, here's the fun fact, because I love to talk about this because I have no problem saying this, but like if people really look behind the curtain to see what the FLC, how many fingers do you have, Chris? Can you count the amount of like full timers that are devoted to the FLCCC. You don't even need two hands. It's literally like five or six of us.
Yep.
And we absolutely need to hire more staff. And so any support is great, but like some of us are actually starting to, we're getting kind of really burnt out and exhausted, because when you say punching above our weight, I would just say that we have global asks of us. I mean, we have many countries, organizations, legal actions, lawyers. Everybody's asking us for like affidavits, sharing of papers, and that's beyond like patients and doctors groups and different that want me to lecture and interview and podcast. And it's like we're literally at full tilt all the time, and we're exhausted. And so any help that can be afforded to us would be really greatly appreciated.
Well, you deserve every bit of it, and you are one of the organizations making one of the biggest differences I know about at this stage. And I do believe that there's a brighter future on the other side of this, and we come out of this hopefully with a reformed health system, with a better sense of agency and understanding of disease processes. And I've certainly learned a lot along the way, and I've learned a lot from you and from Paul and from the other FLCCC people. So it's been a real joy, and I want to thank you for your time today, because I know you are very busy all the time. So thank you so much for your time today and for the positive view of how things could be.
You kidding me? This is the fun stuff, getting to chat with friends. So thanks. It was really nice to talk to you.